that one.
Yeah, that's all right. Thank you.
Say a couple of words of introduction.
Turn it over to you.
You can do that. Prepared a couple of things.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Grunfeld, chairman of the speakers program. Welcome. Cut it out. We were searching around for a comedian, and some guy calls up and he says, "My name is Jack Benny." So I say, "So what?" 39 years ago, Jack Benny was born in Chicago, Illinois.
And 39 years ago, I was 39.
Still going stronger than ever. He's done a lot of TV specials lately. He's performing with a lot of symphony orchestras throughout the world. Very active in charitable organizations. Without much more to say, I mean, here he is. Here he is, the greatest comedian of all times, Mr. Jack Benny.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really not the greatest comedian of all times. You know who's the greatest comedian? Whoever you personally happen to think is the greatest comedian. They go to people, you have fans come to see you, and they'll say, "We love you. We think you're the best comedian in the whole world." And about 12 minutes later, they'll run into Red Skelton. And they'll say, "Red, you're the greatest." So I don't know. I think it's whoever they are fans of. A lot of people will say, "Jack, you and Bob Hope." Or they'll go to Bob. And incidentally, Bob and I were in Jacksonville, Florida, not long ago. What, is it all right for me to talk now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Anytime. I don't know. I haven't been to school in years. I wouldn't. But Bob Hope and I, we were in Jacksonville, Florida, the Jacksonville University, in which we both received doctorates of fine arts, which meant, I imagine, comedy. Mine, I think, was associated with music. And Bob as a comedian. And we were supposed to get these awards or these tributes at separate times. So a lady who is the dean of the Jacksonville University, or deaness, or whatever they call them, she called me and said, "Jack, how would you like," thank you, she said, "how would you like, instead of getting this doctorate separately, you and Bob, how would you like to have it with Bob together? Maybe you'll have a lot more fun out of it," you see? So I said, "I'd love it. It all depends on how Bob feels." She says, "We already called Bob." And Bob said he would like it that way very much. Now, Bob Hope and I happen to be very, very dear close friends. I think next to George Burns, Bob Hope is the closest friend that I have, really, in all of show business. We have a great, what they call, a sort of an admiration pact, both socially and professionally. Bob thinks I'm the best, I think he's the best, and if you ask him, and that's the way it goes. And so we had a lot of fun. The only thing is, he made me laugh too soon. And you kids might be too young to appreciate what I'm going to tell you, what he said to me when we first put on the cap and gown and we walked on the stage, and we were supposed to be serious for a minute. And Bob turned to me and said, he looked at us. Here we are in cap and gown. He says, "You want to know something, Jack? We make Kay Kaiser look like nothing." Now, a lot of you don't remember Kay Kaiser in Cap and Gown, or do you? Because he had the musical knowledge, I don't know, something. He had an orchestra, and he was always dressed in cape and gown, cap and gown, you see. So I was laughing right away when I wasn't supposed to. It was a little too soon to laugh before we received our tribute, you see. But do you know, the nicest part of a lecture or this kind of a thing is when people ask questions and you can answer them. It's like a press. I always do this at a press party. I sit them in a group like you have here, only we only have maybe 12, 13 people. And they will all ask questions, and I answer them, and then they can each pick out what they want and use it in the paper, you see. Now, I must tell you something. You know, there's a school named after me in my hometown, Waukegan, Illinois. It's called the Jack Benny Junior High School. And it was built 9 years ago. Now, this was when people say to me, what is the proudest moment of your entire career? I think I would have to say when my hometown, Waukegan, Illinois, built a school, and they built it to be named after me. They didn't take a pool room and make a school out of it, you know, and then say, we'll call it the Jack Benny Schoolroom. They actually built the most beautiful high school, and I was there for the groundbreaking. And then they opened this school about 9 years ago. It's a beautiful modern school. It's called the Jack Benny Junior High School. Now, I go there occasionally, and I speak to the classes. And I've got to tell you one of the funniest things that happened. You see, it being a junior high school, they have, wait a minute, I'll tell you the names of the other high schools. The Thomas Jefferson and the Daniel Webster. Imagine Daniel Webster, Thomas Jefferson, and Jack Benny. I think they're going to have an Abraham Lincoln one there, too. I used to do a joke about that, but it's just a joke, of course. But it might be funny as long as I mention they're going to build the Abraham Lincoln School. And I told them there when I spoke that I was so happy about that because the only thing that I was interested in when I went to school was American history. I hated everything else. In fact, I flopped in everything else and was thrown out of high school my first year for not studying. And yet there's a school named after me. So you can imagine how ridiculous that is. But I used to do a joke about it. I was so glad that Abraham Lincoln, because he was my favorite president. And the reason I said he was my favorite president, because I said any man that'll walk 12 miles barefoot in the snow and return a library book to save 3 cents is my kind of a guy. I think. I wanted to get a laugh long enough so I could drink some water. Well, anyway, now I had to go there. I usually go there diploma time, you see, and I give out some of the diplomas. Now I go to the different classes and I talk, and let me tell you what happened the last time I was there. One of the classes, they were the youngest, smallest kids in it you've ever seen, and I swear that over half of the kids didn't even know who I was. Actually did not know who Jack Benny was, because they were small, you know, and by this time, I had stopped doing my weekly radio and television shows, and I was doing specials, like two a year, which went on at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, and they couldn't stay up to hear it. So we got to a point where we came to the place where there's supposed to be questions and answers. Now, don't forget, this is called the Jack Benny Junior High School. And here are little kids in there who don't even know who the hell I am, you know. Well, anyway, finally, they asked questions, those who did know all about me, and asked me questions, and I answered them, you know, the best way that I could. And finally, a little girl raised her hand. I take an oath. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a true story. I take an oath. She raised her hand. I said, yes, honey, what is it? She says, Mr. Benny. I said, yes. Why did they name you after our school? Well, you never heard such a scream from people who did know who I was. And then I had to go through a whole explanatory thing to this little kid in the class that I was some kind of a star, you know, that I was somebody in show business, and that Waukegan felt that I have done a lot for Waukegan. I really didn't, because Waukegan isn't much bigger now than it was when I lived there, when I was a kid, so I don't think I did too much for Waukegan. But for those, and it was such a, you see, little kids, they ask the right things, you know. They know exactly what to say. They know exactly, you know, they're so different. Like, kids, let me explain something to you. You know, I play Las Vegas quite often, maybe 2-3 times a year. And everybody asks for autographs. Now, there's an old expression, of course, there's no fool like an old fool. Now, sometimes some old person, a man or a woman, will ask me for an autograph, and they'll be very silly about it or try to be funny. But you never find it with little kids. See, little kids, they have no inhibitions, and they don't know what it means to be funny. If they want an autograph, they'll come right up in a very nice way and ask me. Now, I was playing in Las Vegas. It was last in the summer. So this is when the parents take their kids to Las Vegas. They might not be able to go in and hear Buddy Hackett, but they can come in to hear me. So finally, a little girl walked up to me. I want to show you how smart some of these kids can be. And she says, Mr. Benny, my mother and I, my father, we saw your show last night, and I enjoyed it very much. And I said, thank you. And she had the cutest face you've ever seen in your life. A little, she couldn't have been, I doubt if she were 9 years old. So finally she said to me, Mr. Benny, may I have your autograph? I said, you certainly may, but let me tell you something, young lady. I charge for autographs. Now, I was going to have a little bit of fun with her, and let me tell you how she made a fool out of me. I said, I charge. So she laughed. She knew I was kidding. And she said, what do you charge? Hey, well, a face like yours, I'll give you an autograph, but you must give me a kiss. I charge a kiss for little girls for an autograph. She says, all right. So she gave me her autograph book, and I signed it, and I said, now wait a minute, before I give it to you, the autograph, you must give me a kiss. So she gave me a kiss. Now she walked away, and I swear she wasn't 8 steps away when she ran back. She says, Mr. Benny, I said, yes. She says, what do you charge little boys? Isn't that something? Now, for a little kid to think of that, to think of sex in that way. I had a couple of things that I didn't want to forget that I wanted to talk about, because as a rule, you know, people want to know. When they ask me to deliver a lecture or to talk, they like to know something about show business, or they like to know something about comedy or humor, which is humor, of course. And what is funny and what isn't funny? Now, what is funny is the most difficult question to answer that any comedian has ever been asked. It's so much more difficult to answer. There's a great difference between drama and comedy, and yet they are akin. But there is a difference in this way. It's almost easy to answer questions about dramatics or dramatic actors or drama because they have rules, certain set rules about acting that you must learn and you must study and you must know. Where comedians, every comedian can be entirely different and they don't work exactly alike. I don't know of two comedians who actually work exactly alike or whose style of humor isn't entirely different than someone else's. So it gets to the point, like, let me put it this way. If you took a poll of 20 or 30 or 40 people and asked each one of them what they thought comedy was, what they thought was funny, you could get 40 different answers, and each one would be correct. Each answer would be right, because each one has maybe a different sense of humor. Like, for instance, if somebody likes me very much, he probably would not be the same type of an audience that would like Red Skelton. And yet it could be. It could like both of us, you know. But it depends on trying to explain humor, because that's, I imagine, one of the reasons I'm here, is about as difficult as anything that I can think of. Because I know I never studied it. To me, everything was an accident. Do you know what I was when I was first in show business? I was a fiddler. That's what I was. I was a fiddler. And then during the First World War, I joined the Navy. And we had a sailor show. You want to know how I became a comedian? I'm going to tell you. Whether you want to know it or not, you're going to hear it. How I became a comedian. We had a sailor show when I was in the Navy, because this was the what they call the Navy Relief Society. And they had a sailor show called the Great Lakes Review. And I was merely supposed to play the fiddle and be in the chorus. Now, there was a part that the author wrote for an admiral's orderly who was supposed to be a comedian. So he had to pick somebody out, and I swear by accident, at random, he pointed to me and he says, "Hey, young fella, come over here. Don't forget I was a young fella then. It's the First World War, you know." He says, "Come here a minute. I've got 3-4 lines I want you to read." And they were comedy lines. Well, I didn't know whether I could read comedy lines or anything about it, but I read them. And he thanked me. And the next day, we went back to rehearsal, and he called me over, and he had 6 or 7 more lines for me. And at each rehearsal, my part got bigger and bigger and bigger. And when the show opened at the auditorium in Chicago, I had the comedy part of the show. And that's how I became a comedian. Now, maybe I would have become a comedian anyway. But I have to give this author credit. His name was David Wolfe. Give him credit for calling me over. It could have been somebody else. And this is how I became a comedian. But don't forget, I also had a lot of nerve because I had on a uniform, a sailor uniform, which perhaps gave me a little more guts, you know, to be able to do this. I didn't have guts as a fighter. As a comedian, yes. You see? So that's how I became a comedian. And as soon as the war was over and I went back into show business, I still took the fiddle with me because I was frightened, you know. And I'd have the fiddle in one hand and the bow in the other. And I would do a lot of gags and talk. And the fact that I had the violin and the bow with me made all my talk sound impromptu. It made it sound as though I were ad-libbing. Because they always felt that I was ready to play the violin. And I was making up things as I went along. And believe me, I wasn't. I knew every word I was going to say. And I found out that I could also write pretty good for myself. Now you ask, I've had people ask me, now there are different kinds of comedians. There are the one-liners. Now take Bob Hope, who is a great comedian. But Bob Hope does like one-liners. He'll tell a joke, another joke, another joke. A lot of them do that. But I seem to find out, I must have known this innately, that, innately is the right word, isn't it? Huh?
Yeah.
My God, I don't want to make a mistake here. That I must have found out, actually, by myself, that it isn't good for me as a comedian to just do one joke after another, joke about a glass of water, and the next minute a joke about a microphone or something. This is not right for me. I must talk on subjects. And if I change a subject, and this is the way I always do it, and you'll usually find it that way, whether I play Las Vegas or whether I'm on television or whatever I do, you'll usually find that I'll stay on a subject as long as I can, and when I change the subject, I try to change it so gracefully that you as an audience don't even realize I changed the subject. Now that's my type of humor. Somebody else's is entirely different. Some are one-liners who just talk. Now, Bob Newhart, who I think is a great, great comedian, he also has a way of talking and talking and talking on a subject. Then he has pieces of business that he does in between, you know? I'm a great admirer of his. If a person were to say to me, how did you become a comedian? That's the only way I can explain it. Now, maybe even if that author hadn't asked me, I might have become a comedian because I started as a fiddler even before the First World War. Imagine how long ago that was. I was a better fiddler then than I am now. And now I give concerts. Which shows you how ridiculous that is. Is it? But I would like to say now that there should be a question and answer period, because otherwise, if I just talk, I'll probably forget a lot of things I would like to say to you, where I won't, if you ask questions that you'd like to know. Maybe I can answer them, maybe I can't. But I'll certainly try. And I usually get the best results that way, and so do you, as an audience. And if anybody wants to ask a question,
there are two standing mics. There are two standing mics, one on either end, so that we can pick it up so the rest of the audience can hear the question. Also, while we're waiting for people to get to the microphones, I'd like to ask you a question about a story I heard, and perhaps you could tell me if it's true or not.
He's the first one. What?
I understand once, like, you were at an airport, and it was like a pay telephone, and like after leaving, you had forgotten your wallet in there, and not having any money, you had to climb underneath the door, and one of your friends caught you, which sort of, I guess, reinforced your image of being cheap.
Would you like to hear that story? Huh? It didn't happen in an airport. It happened on my way going to the airport was in San Francisco. Now, I want to show you what an embarrassing position you can get into when you have built up a character of being stingy. Now, I don't mind having a characterization of being very stingy because it's a funny one. It's the one where you can get the biggest laughs by being stingy, because every family has somebody in it who's stingy, you see. So, now, the reason I also don't mind being stingy is because actually I'm not. I think Mary and I, my wife and I, spend more money than any two people in show business. That's why I'm working so much. If you want to know the real truth, we both spend a bloody fortune. So therefore, I don't mind it. It's like I don't, let me try to explain that. It's like I don't believe that Carol O'Connor is actually a, what is that word?
A bigot.
I don't believe he's a bigot, because if he were actually a bigot, I don't think he could play that character, you see? As a matter of fact, when I used to do my specials, I had four writers. And one of my writers was so stingy in real life, really so tight, that I used to ask him, how can you write funny things for me when you are that stingy yourself? And he merely laughed. You know, it didn't bother him. He didn't. But the story that you want to tell, this is a true story, and I'll tell you what it was. I was in San Francisco, and I was living at the Fairmont Hotel. I was there to do a benefit. And the next morning, we had to leave for the airport. Someone picked us up. I was there with my manager. So we go downstairs, and when I went downstairs, if you'll pardon me, I had to go to the bathroom. So I thought, well, I'm not going all the way upstairs again. I'm going the one in the lobby, the men's room. So I go inside, and I look in my pocket, and I had a quarter and a dime. So I put the dime in, and I went to the bathroom. Now, we leave, and we get into the airport. We're driving towards the airport, and I look at my back pocket, and I cannot find my wallet, which was a checkbook and a wallet. Now, I didn't mind. I didn't have that much money in it, but you always have cards and everything. You don't want to lose it. So I said, oh, my goodness, I left my wallet in my room. Have we got time to go back? The driver says, we've got plenty of time. So he drives me back. This is word for word the way it happened. He drives me back to the hotel. I'm glad you mentioned that, by the way. And I go up to the bedroom, and I'm looking all over for this checkbook and wallet, and I can't find it. So I thought, well, I don't know. So I had to leave. I go down. As I went downstairs, I thought, wait a minute. Maybe it dropped out of my trousers into the men's room. So I go over there, I got just about enough time run, and I looked under, and there is my checkbook. Now I look in my pocket, and I've only got a quarter. And there's nobody around there to get change, and I didn't want to run back. I had to leave. I had to get to the airport. So I thought, well, I'm only going to sneak under there and get the and get the wallet. So I started to crawl under there, and wouldn't you know, a man walked in, and when I stuck my head out, he recognized me.
Now we'll just alternate between microphones.
Now,
We'll alternate between microphones. Okay?
You want to do what?
We'll take a question from there.
Oh, yeah. But wait a minute. Now, I haven't finished this yet. So finally, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know what to do. And he had a sort of a silly smile on his face. Because now he really thought I was trying to sneak in there. So I took an oath. I says, look at mister, I know you know I'm Jack Benny. I want you to do me a favor. I've been in here once. I paid the dime. I said, now look under there, and that's where I lost my wallet. Now, if you got change for a quarter, I'll be able to go in and get it. He said, no, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the dime. Because, by God, this story is worth it. And he gave me a dime, I put it in, got my wallet, and went to the airport.
Isn't that a story for you? Fantastic story. I read that.
Huh?
I died laughing the first time I heard it.
Oh, sure. That really hope. I told it on one of the talk show, Johnny Carson show or something. I don't remember. Now.
Let's have a question from over there. Anybody?
Mr. Benny, do you think
yeah.
that it's... I wonder what your opinion is on the thought that...
Can you hear that? Can you hear what he said?
He hasn't finished.
I don't hear too.
No.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible that making stinginess the object of derision encourages free spending and tends to help inflation?
Now, I didn't get the whole sentence, so tell me what he said.
Does making stinginess the object of derision tend to increase free spending and then result in inflation?
Tell me exactly what it
is. Making stinginess an object of derision tend to increase or tend to influence people to spend and thus cause inflation.
Well, I'll tell you what it's done to me. This character that I play costs me a fortune that I have to spend an awful lot of money to compensate for being so cheap. So whether that has anything to do with whether I'm helping inflation or hurting it, I don't know. But I know that wherever I go, when I go to a restaurant with people, and I treat people, I have to leave a great big tip, a bigger tip than any wealthy man would have to give, just because of the stingy character, you see? And I'll tell you something very funny, if you'd like to hear about that. About once, you know, I'm a very big tipper to taxi drivers, and I'll tell you why. I always have a feeling that if I take a cab and I only go a short distance, maybe I'm taking someone away from a good corner, you know? So this happened in Las Vegas. I had to go from the Sahara Hotel to the Riviera. And I think it was like, I don't know, $1.10. Something like that. And when I got out of the cab, I gave the driver $3, and I told him to keep the change. Now, wait till you hear what he said to me, and forgive me for using the word, because it's the only way I can explain it, and it's the only way it's funny. He said to me, Mr. Benny, I'm sorry you did that. I'm sorry you gave me such a good tip. Don't forget, it was a $1.90 tip for $1.10. I'm sorry you did that. He said, why? He said, because I wanted to be able to go home and tell my wife what a cheap son of a bitch you are, and I couldn't do it. So I said to him, yes, you can. Just give me back the tip. He said, oh, no. No, he says, that I won't do. But I do. I tip. I'm a big tipper. I spend a lot of money, particularly on tips, because of this character, of my cheap, stingy character. Now, whether that has anything to do with it, will have anything to do with inflation, I don't know. My one person won't be able to do it or help it or hurt it in any way.
There's a question from there?
I have a question about Thomas Brandon's play, Charlie's Aunt. I'm a very fond fan of that, Charlie's Aunt, and I was wondering how you got the part, and also, why did they change the idea of Charlie as being a 38-year-old college student, instead of the way it was written in the play.
You got to help me with these. I don't hear that good.
Sorry, I didn't hear it either.
Something about, I know it's something about Charlie's aunt that you want to know about the movie I made.
I'll repeat the question then.
All right.
My question is...
Yes?
...that Charlie's aunt was supposed to be a college student, and
yes.
you played a 38-year-old college student.
Yes.
Why did they change the idea of what was going on? You look young enough to play a college student. He did.
Well, I think I know what you're getting at. Let me tell you how embarrassed I was about making that picture. It was a very funny picture, and everybody who made Charlie's Aunt was very successful with it, and I think, I hate to say this, but I think I made one of the best Charlie Aunt pictures. Ann Baxter was in it. She was just a little kid. The only embarrassing part of it for me was, as you mentioned, the school, is when we went to the premiere of the picture at the Chinese Theater, the first 20 minutes of it, I had to be a college boy. Well, for God's sakes, even then I could have been a college boy's grandfather. And I want to tell you, when that first 20 minutes went on, and even though I made this a long time ago, I was still too old to be a college boy. And I sat in my seat like this, so embarrassed, and was filled with entertainers and the all who knew me. And it was embarrassing until I got into my Charlie's Aunt costume. And then it was funny. But the first few minutes of that was murder. It really was. If I don't know whether I'm answering your question, because you did want to know something about my going to college at that age, isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's it. I was very embarrassed about it. You want to know the real truth? Once I got into the costume, it was all right. But they had no... But do you know what? Let me tell you what happened not long ago. Do you know that many times studios do not think of comedians and some of us in terms of age? Now, you know, Bob Hope is about 10 years younger than I am. But they offer us parts. Do you know that not long ago, I would say about 12 years ago, I was offered a part, a script sent me, where they wanted me to play the part of a baseball pitcher in his prime. Which was so ridiculous. You know, this was really ridiculous. A baseball pitcher in his prime, who is, by the time he's 40, he's practically through, you know. But that's because they see us so often that I don't think even people in the audiences think of us in terms of age. As long as you don't get ill, you know, if you stay healthy, and if you look good, I try to look as good as I can. I try to stay as thin as I can, because if I'm going to stay in show business, and so does Bob, if I'm going to stay in show business, I want to look as good as I can or get the hell out of the business, one or the other. So I try to look as young as I can. Now, I know that I know I look younger than I am. But I think so. Thank you.
I'd like to make a short announcement about Unicamp.
Huh?
I'd like to make a short announcement about Unicamp, and that's where you plug in about it.
Okay, go ahead.
A word from our sponsor. I've heard that Unicamp is collecting here this week, and from what I've been told, it's a very worthwhile cause. There is a barrel in the back of the room, and it would be nice if each of you on the way out could maybe drop a small contribution, your quarters, your pennies, your nickels, your dimes, or whatever.
Wait a minute. Explain that a little more to me. What's that for?
Unicamp is a camp for the underprivileged, the diabetic, I believe physically...
I have diabetes, by the way, but it's so light that I eat anything.
I believe some physically disabled children, handicapped, underprivileged children. It's the campus charity. It's the probably one of the few good things the campus does worthwhile for the community.
Well, look. Wait a minute. Look. What's your first name?
Jeff.
Jeff. That's right, Jeff. You go. If I give money, they've got to give money. Huh? They're stuck.
I certainly hope so. I certainly
hope. All right. Now, wait a minute.
Oh!
I'll tell you what I will. I'll do. I'll put in $20. Now, they got to put in something.
$20 for Mr. Benny.
Now, I want to show you something. I got smaller change. There's a $10 bill and a dollar. I wanted to show off. That was the whole thing.
Like
so we're starting it off with $20.
I'd like to thank Mr. Benny on behalf of Unicamp.
You are welcome.
Let's have another question here from the mic.
Yes. My question is, how are the alligators?
How what?
How are the alligators?
Oh, well, that is a question that a lot of people wouldn't understand. But I'm glad he remembers it. Now, that's marvelous. He must be a very young fella. You know the vault that I used to have in radio? Those who remember the radio, and then a little bit in television. But television was tougher to get the vault seen in. But to protect my vault, I had a moat with alligators in it. I don't think they're there anymore. I don't think. But that's nice that you remember that far back. I think that's nice.
Mr. Benny?
Yeah.
I'd like to know how you first met Fred Allen.
Well, now, that's a nice question, and it's a question that I'd like to answer because they usually ask it in a different way. They usually say that, how did the feud start with Fred Allen? Now, naturally, I've known Fred Allen for years and years before the feud because we were both comedians in vaudeville, see? And one day, all these things that happened to me that were good happened by accident. One day, Fred Allen had a little 10-year-old boy play the B on the violin. And Fred knew I always, excuse me, Fred knew I always listened to his program. And he said to the boy, how old are you, after he played the B? And he said he was 10 years old. Now he's almost 50 or 40. So then Fred made derogatory remarks about me as a violinist, knowing I was listening. So the next week I answered him. Then the following week he answered me. And this went on. I want to tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. This went on for about 8 months, this feud, before we even got together on the telephone to discuss what we're going to do next. And that's why it was successful. Because if Fred Allen and I, or anybody, any couple, said, let's have a feud, it would have turned out lousy. Because it would have been, I don't know, it wouldn't have been a natural feud. This way, we just kept, you know, making derogatory remarks, panning each other, without even talking to each other. He was in New York, and I was in Los Angeles. And we kept this feud on until it got to a point where we felt we ought to appear together. And that's how we got on the phone, Fred Allen. He was a great wit. You know what he said about me once? He said, made the funniest remark you've ever heard. Before they built the school for me in Waukegan, years ago, they wanted to pay me some kind of a tribute. And they planted a tree in Waukegan, a little tree in the courthouse square, and the tree died. And on Fred Allen's next program, he said, you know, he had that nasal voice, he said, how can a tree live in Waukegan with the sap in Hollywood?
That's right.
Ha ha. hey, everybody's leaving. What is it, dinner?
They've got to go to class.
We probably have time for one more question. All right, we have time for one more question. I got all the time in the world.
I'm going to put in one more
question. Yes, Mr. Benny?
I have one more question for Unicamp.
You are. You can do whatever you want. You're not going to get any more money from me, though.
I hope I'm not beating a dead horse. Just one more plug for Unicamp. Mardi Gras is coming up, and all proceeds of that will go to Unicamp as well. So I hope you can do your best to attend that and have all your friends come down.
Mr. Benny, you said you became a comedian just by accident and a combination of lucky breaks. How does one who's very determined get into comedy today?
How does one become a comedian?
I didn't catch
how
the
How does
end.
One who is very determined to get into comedy, how does he get into the field?
A lot of lucky breaks to make a comedian. How does one determine to become a comedian today, find those lucky breaks?
That is the tough question to answer. The only way, I wouldn't know how. I wouldn't know how. Now, I mentioned Bob Newhart before. He used to be an accountant. And he used to make speeches at their committee meetings or whatever it was. And he found out he was funny. And he got laughs, and that's how he got into show business. But how you would study to be a comedian, I don't know. I think some way, you have to find out by yourself that your delivery is right, that even in conversation maybe with people, that it's right. I'll swear, I bet there must be some one person in this room, whether it's a girl or a boy, that could become a fine comedian. But if you said to me, how do you become the comedian? I swear, I don't know how. I don't know. Now, if you have a beautiful voice, that you know what you can do. You can sing, and then you can talk between songs and maybe become a fine comedian. You see, look at Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor. But how you just go out to become a comedian, I wish I knew how to answer that question. And nobody has ever been able to answer that question, I don't think. There might be schools, maybe there are classes for it in schools, where someone knows how to try them out, how to give them a routine of talk to do and see what it sounds like and hear what it sounds like. Maybe that way. Are there classes for that?
I don't know.
They're not here.
Mr. Benny?
Huh?
Right over here. This is God. There probably aren't very many classes to become a comedian. It's more of a natural ability. But my real question is, how do you get the people that have the authority to say, hey, you're funny, and I'm going to put you in front of a camera and put you on stage, and we can make money with you, and you can really become a celebrity? How do you get that person to listen to you?
Did you hear all that?
Yeah.
What?
Was he saying that he feels that a lot of people have the ability? Okay. Maybe himself or something, but he goes, how does he get the people who have the authority, you know, the people who are in it to say, hey, I like you, you know, why not come and I'll give you a break? How do you get to meet those people?
Well, this is a very tough thing, too, is to meet the people once you have the ability. You have to be discovered. Now your next question naturally would be, well, how do you become discovered? How do you get discovered? If you know somebody who knows a producer or an agent or a representative who can book you someplace, because it's very difficult to be discovered just trying something out in a room or an office. You actually have to work someplace. And if you knew somebody well enough that could get you that kind of a job, who he himself has faith in you, so that he can say to a representative, I have a friend that I think is a good comedian, I wish you'd go over and see him. That's the only possible way that I could know how to do it. Because, oh boy, I can't tell you the people that I've tried to help, and it's been murder. You know, if I try to help a girl, even, a lot of them think, oh, there must be something going on there between he and the girl, or he wouldn't be trying to help. They don't believe you, you know.
How about like a few closing remarks, or would you like to take one more question? Because like everyone is breaking for class now.
All right, if everybody's breaking for class. The only closing remark I can say is that I'm very flattered that I was invited to be here, and I enjoyed talking because I like to hear myself talk anyway. And I love the audiences, and I think their questions were right. I wish I could have heard them a little bit better. And if at some future time, when there will be other people and they will have forgotten what I said, invite me again, and I'll be glad to come back here again. It's been a great pleasure.
Benny, thank you for coming.